Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to start off today with a Measure 37 update from our director, Lane Shetterly. Lane, would you come forward? It's going to be a pretty familiar chair for you.
It's heated.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I brought my lawyer with me today. With me is Richard Whitman from the Natural Resources section of the Department of Justice. Mr. Chair, we'll hear your invitation. I've got a couple of opening remarks, if you like, and then I'd just be happy to throw it open to questions.
Thank
What's
you.
What's your pleasure?
That would be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you said update, and that was not part of what I anticipated, but I'll tell you that I think we are at about 100 claims filed with the state now that have been submitted to DAS. As of today, I believe 64 of those claims have been forwarded to the Department of Land Conservation and Development and are in process or will be in process of evaluation. The others are still under review at DAS for completeness, but we have a claims process that is moving forward to the state. No decisions have been made on any of those. Obviously, we're still in the front end of the pipeline, but I have five staff at the department now that are engaged in review of ballot measure 37 claims. Mr. Chair, I think there was some question, and what I wanted to address, at least at the outset today, because I think it's important, and to clarify on the record what our communication has been to local governments relative to our shared and mutual responsibilities with regard to ballot measure 37 claims. I have provided the committee with copies of correspondence that goes back to November 26th of 2004, a letter from me to that we mailed out to all cities and counties statewide, giving them some initial information about the state claims process and information and resources that we were going to be able to provide to local governments. During that same time, they developed a regular communication with me and Richard Whitman on behalf of the state, along with Ray Naft from the governor's office, and representatives of League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties, because we could see that there were plenty of pitfalls and opportunities for miscommunication in the application of this measure between state and local government. And so back in December, we started meeting on a weekly basis, and those meetings continue today.
If I can interrupt you just for a moment to set maybe for the committee a little more of why I've asked you here specifically to address the issue with the counties. I had had telephone conversations with the commissioners in Jackson County, and we know, as you indicated, Yamhill County yesterday began the claim process. Jackson County begins today. The question that the counties brought up was, how do, if we issue a claim or waiver to an individual, and it winds up that that was a violent, that we're talking about a state regulation, does that applicant have to have previously filed with the state as well as with the counties? The county's position has been to forward me to statute 197.646, which is the statute that the committee members have a copy of. That is what the counties are saying they are going by in their claim process, and why they're not telling their claimants that they have to also file with the state. Okay. So somewhere along the line, perhaps Mr. Whitman is going to be able to help us when we get into that issue, and I'm sorry for the interruption of your
That's okay, because I was getting to the letter of December 23, which is also in your materials that I have distributed to you. You will note that that letter is jointly issued from the League, from me on behalf of the state, and also from the Association of Oregon Counties, and it is an outgrowth of those meetings that we have held weekly with them, discussing that very question, among others, but who has the authority and the responsibility to issue a waiver, and what's the situation, what occurs when you have a county ordinance that implements a state mandate so that you've got both a county level regulation and a state level regulation. Is it good enough for a claimant if a county issues a waiver, or for that matter if the state issues a waiver? Is it good for both? Frankly, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask Mr. Whitman to address the particulars of the analysis, but the upshot is we don't know, based on the language of the measure. When I say we, that's AOC, LOC, and the state. I have done probably 10, 15 forums on ballot measure 37 since the election, and I would say that the consensus among those who have looked at this and addressed the question is that it's not clear. And even the Oregonians in Action website recommends that a claimant file a claim in both the county and the state, where they have those two levels of claims. We've adopted the same recommendation. It's on page 2 of our joint letter of December 23. At the very top of the page, it says local governments should instruct claimants who file claims at the local level that they should also file a claim with the state if the claim appears to involve a state land use regulation. That is the best advice, and the reason we think that's the best advice is really for the benefit of the property owner. We're not so far into the measure yet to see these situations develop, but it's certainly possible, and if I was back in my legal practice advising a client, and we had both a state and a local regulation, for that client's protection, I'd say get a waiver on both. If you get a waiver on one, you proceed with a use that is not permitted under another regulation that still is in effect because it has not been waived by the unit of government that has imposed that. There may be complications down the road, either from a neighbor. It may certainly complicate if you go to a bank for a loan and the bank says, where's your ticket to build this house, and you present the county's waiver, and the bank lawyer says, well, there's also a state statute or a state rule or regulation. Where's that waiver? You could put that property owner at that point of having to go back to the beginning and do it again. And so it's just a rule, I think, a matter of convenience that we are suggesting, and this is uniform, that claimants who have the possibility of claims in both local and state regulations should file in both places. Until we get some clarification, either from the legislature or from the courts, I think that is the best practice for the benefit of claimants. And again, that's our advice. We have not told counties that their waivers are invalid unless they get sign-off from us. Their waivers are valid for their ordinances. The question really is, what does the property owner need to best secure the benefits of the measure?
Now, I know, Lane, at my request, Bob Rindy attempted to converse with the Jackson County commissioners can try to clear up the issue one way or the other, in that I know the counties and cities who are beginning to handle these claims are having these kind of questions come up. What was the Jackson County Commissioner's response when you tried to reiterate to them your interpretation?
No, Mr. Chair, I haven't spoken with the Jackson County Commissioners. I put a call in yesterday to Commissioner Walker and a call in today, as a matter of fact, and gave him my cell phone as well as my desk phone, and have not heard back. I am going down to Medford next week. so I'll have a chance to pursue this. But certainly they have received these same letters that we have issued. And my message to the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, and in fact I did meet with Commissioner Walker at the Association of Oregon Counties meeting in December, has been consistent from day one, that we don't impose this. We don't see this as a requirement under the measure, but that it is a matter of best practice for the benefit of claimants. In fact, I know that Jackson County's ordinance, actually their claim forms recommend that a claimant file a claim with the state if there is a state regulation that applies as well. So as far as I can tell, their process is entirely consistent with the advice that we have issued jointly with the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities.
Perhaps for the committee's benefit, a governing body making a decision on a claim has three options. Could you go into those options and give us your definition of those options?
I might invite you to join me on this one, Mr. Chair. The options, if a claim is presented, the options are, well, first of all, to pay compensation. That's the first option. And in lieu of compensation, the governing body has the options to, the government has the option to modify, remove, or not apply the regulation. Again, I'll just tiptoe into that and then I'll segue to Mr. Whitman. Not apply, I think, seems fairly straightforward. Modify, I assume, would comprehend an amendment to an ordinance or a code that imposed a regulation. Remove, I'm not sure what that means. That's not a term that has any particular history or it's not a term of art, I think, in that sense of a rule or a statute, so I'm not sure what remove means. It certainly has a pretty common sense dictionary definition, you take it away, but I don't think there's any history as to what that term means in the context of a measure like this.
And the reason we're putting an emphasis on this, because one of the more contentious points on Measure 37 is the transferability of a claim, and that may have a direct dealing with which one of those options a government should choose to make a determination in.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice. As Lane has just ably described, government has a number of alternatives in terms of what to do when it is presented with a Measure 37 claim that it determines is valid. So that I want to make it clear, that's the first assumption that I'm making, is that the government has a valid Measure 37 claim in front of it. Again, the government can pay compensation in the form of a reduction in the amount of the reduction in fair market value. That's the first basic option. It can remove the law that was the basis for the claim. And I think our working assumption is that remove means to make the law go away in some permanent form, probably by repealing it. Modify the law, which would, as Lane said, probably be an amendment of the law that was the basis for the claim, or not apply it, which means, I think, in a common sense application, that it's not going to apply the law to that particular use, that particular property owner. Mr. Chair, you noted that the transferability issue may depend on the type of relief that is granted, and if I could comment just briefly on that. Obviously, if government repeals a law, that law is no longer going to apply to anybody, including a future owner of the property.
So if a government entity chooses that, right, then that regulation is gone, period. In essence, would transfer with the property.
Mr. Chair, I think that's our working assumption.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, believe me.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, when I say that's our working assumption, let me clarify a little bit what I mean by that. there are a lot of questions that everybody has about how Measure 37 works, and of course we're working very hard to try to implement Measure 37 and get it going on the ground. But I think looking realistically, many of the questions that people have about Measure 37 are going to have to be resolved either by the courts through litigation or through legislative clarification of the measure. So when I'm telling you these are sort of working assumptions, this is sort of operationally what we're assuming for the moment until we're told otherwise by you, the legislature, or by a court. So
is it your opinion, Mr. Whitman, that Measure 37 is not definitive enough in these areas?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any opinion as to whether Measure 37 is definitive enough. As I said, we have the law on the books. It's been passed by the voters, and we're working to implement it. There are some difficulties in terms of trying to determine what the voters intended, but we will work through those until we are told to do so otherwise by either the legislature or a court.
And what type of interpretation of the voter are you dealing with? I mean, you just said that's part of what you're trying to interpret. What issue in the voters' ballot measure 37 is a question mark in your mind?
Mr. Chair, there are a lot of questions that have been raised in the public, including the question that you have asked us here to talk about today, this question of who may decide to not apply a particular law. We're trying to work through all of those issues just as we work through the claims, working with the LCD and deciding what to do on individual claims. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
you look like you want to say something.
Well, of course, your committee heard, I think, about 3 weeks ago in the joint meeting with the Senate. You heard, I think, several issues not raised by us, but by other witnesses who appeared before you, and I think those are the same kinds of questions that we are getting on a regular basis.
Those questions were primarily raised by those who opposed Measure 37.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure. It was the Bankers Association. I don't know if they had a position on the measure. The Realtors Association, I think they were neutral on the measure. The commercial developers, I don't think they had a position on the measure that I'm aware of. I'm not sure that you could say that those questions were all from people opposed to the measure. I think it's people who are dealing with the measure, and probably a mix of both. But I don't think that, I'm not aware the Bankers Association had any position, and I know the Realtors were neutral.
Okay. Do you have any questions from the committee? Representative Ackerman.
I just had a question, and maybe a statement, and then a question. My statement is based upon what I know about the measure and the proceedings I've listened to in this room. The best way to destroy Measure 37 is to do nothing. Then we'll tie this regulation up, or this measure up, in years of litigation, inconsistent results, inability perhaps to finance a improvement that would be sanctioned under 37, and essentially deny, I think, property owners their rights under Measure 37. I think we do that, we can kill the bill. We can kill the measure. But I don't think that's our function. I think we have the will of the people behind us, and we have to make it clear so we have consistent and fair results. Let me ask you if each of you have considered whether there should be certain minimum statewide standards in the claims process and the court's procedures and some other areas that would have statewide concern and would more or less preempt local authority. I'm talking about standardizing some of the basic elements of the claims process. Would that be helpful?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I think that some further clarification on the claims process certainly would help the measure. You have at this point 36 counties and 240 some cities, each with their own claims ordinance. Many of them are off of similar templates, but you have a lot of different varieties out there, some with their processing fee, some without, some that require appraisals, some that don't, different permutations. It's a wonderful thing, local control and the ability to establish local standards. I think some of these have caused consternation in some parts of the state, the differences that are out there, and to the extent that uniformity makes interpretation of the measure easier and clearer to apply, I think that could work to the benefit.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Anderson.
When you're talking repeal, you're talking about repeal for those people after 71 all the way forward to today. Everybody?
I'm sorry.
I guess it was Mr. Whitman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we're talking about one of the types of relief that is provided for under Measure 37 is for the government entity to remove the law that was the basis for the claim, and I stated that sort of our working assumption is remove means repeal. I think we mean repeal in the same sense that if the legislature went in and repealed a statute, for instance in ORS Chapter 215 that regulates the use of farm use land, that sort of repeal, it would apply to everybody, presumably, including anybody who came forward in the future wanting to use that type of property.
It's not a limited appeal, repeal or removal, it's a total removal.
Probably, in terms of distinguishing it from the other types of relief that are provided for under Measure 37.
So there is no such thing as a permanent removal or a temporary removal?
Mr. Chair, I think a temporary, making the law go away on a temporary basis, to use English, is not applying it to that property owner. So that's probably what that prong encompasses.
Well, I've got a couple more here for you, if you don't mind, either one of you. Multnomah County is the only local government that is claiming that Measure 37 doesn't apply to people who want to subdivide their property. Measure 37 defines land use regulation to include local government subdivision ordinances. Do you think Multnomah County is right in their interpretation?
This is
where I'm. Yeah. Well, the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we're prepared to say at this point what our definitive conclusions are concerning whether partition and subdivision laws are encompassed within Measure 37 as laws that can give rise to a Measure 37 claim. We have noted, as have you, that under the definition of land use regulation, it includes land division ordinances. And I think that suggests an answer that may be not in line with the position that Multnomah County has taken, but we have not reached any conclusion on that yet.
Thank you for being candid. I appreciate that. Is there anything in writing, as far as the state's opinion is concerned, as to the transferability of claims?
Mr. Chair, there is nothing in writing yet on the transferability issue. Governor's Council stated what the state's position is on that issue. We are anticipating having something in writing that makes it clear exactly what the Governor's Council was and was not saying. I think there's a danger of over-interpreting what she was saying. So we are expecting to have something out in writing that will clarify exactly what it was she was saying.
One last question for
yes,
Elaine on my part. I can't think of any other state agency that's got to be in the hot seat, so to speak, than yours at the moment. the people of this state need you, and I'm saying you because there isn't anybody else, right, need you to help and to start giving us some definitions of these terms that are elusive and causing the confusion. Can we expect something soon from the Roy Department?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, of course, what you're asking for is essentially a legal interpretation of a measure, because that's what we will apply to our evaluation of claims before the state. That will come from the Department of Justice and not from me, not from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I can tell you that in terms of our response to the claims that are coming in, it's helpful for us to actually have real claims on our desks to be looking at, so we're not dealing with hypothetical questions. There are plenty of hypothetical questions to be asking about this. It's very helpful in these last few weeks to have gotten concrete claims that are on the table that we can begin then to focus our questions on for the Department of Justice to answer. Having said that, we will evaluate claims based on the legal advice we get from the Department of Justice. We will make that advice known in the context of our evaluation. The fact is, of course, that the legal advice we get from the Department of Justice is one or law firm's opinion as to the effect of the measure. So, not to say that it's not valuable to us, and it will be the advice that we will follow, it's not going to be definitive. That is, it will indicate how the state is choosing to interpret the measure, but it's not going to be binding on anybody but state agencies. And so even that advice, once it is issued by the department and then implemented by DLCD in the evaluation and action on our claims, will still be subject to challenge by any number of parties who disagree with that. So we want to get there, but I just want to emphasize that when we get that advice and we hold that up, it's not a talisman, it's an opinion, and it may be a court down the road still that ultimately says whether DOJ got it right and whether we got it right in implementing that advice.
Can I ask Mr. Whitman the same question? How fast is the Department of Justice going to move in issuing opinions, whether they be valid or universally accepted or not?
Mr. Chair, as Director Shetterly has indicated, we are moving quickly to work with the department in working through on what the department's response should be on particular claims. And in the course of that, we are providing legal advice to the department on what we believe the measure means. So I think you will start to see decisions on claims come out from the state in the relatively near future. That's in a matter of probably a month or two, you'll start to see decisions from the state. But I want to emphasize also what Director Shetterly said, that we are not planning on coming out at this point with a comprehensive opinion concerning, what Measure 37 means. We are working with DLCD and other state agencies, providing them advice on how to carry out the measure and put it into effect. And, of course, we're defending the measure. So those are really our focuses at this point.
And I guess my question to you would have to be, why not?
Mr. Chair, I think it's the why not is really a practical matter. We are getting a sufficient number of claims on Measure 37, as our local governments, that we expect there to be a significant amount of litigation in the relatively near future concerning the meaning of the measure. I don't know whether that litigation will involve the state or not. It may primarily involve local government, or it may involve property owners. But I think the reality of the situation is either the courts are going to tell us exactly what Measure 37 means, or the legislature is going to weigh in and try to fix particular problems that arise as we try to carry out the measure. So I think that's why we're not coming out with an opinion, because it's going to be overtaken by events. I think it would be overtaken by events relatively quickly.
I certainly don't want you to take offense at my questions in this regard, but I think the people of the state look to the state for answers. That is our obligation. And I have difficulty with your position from the standpoint that we're going to wait to see how the courts do it. I think you're kind of dodging a responsibility here.
Mr. Chair, if I might, we haven't talked a lot about other work that we are also doing. We are also working very closely with cities and counties to try to work with them to carry out the measure in a way that is, as much as we are able to influence it, consistent across the state, and Director Shetterly talked about those efforts as well. So we are trying to do what we can to provide some leadership for local government and provide a clear process for property owners through rules that have been adopted and work that the Department of Administrative Services is doing in terms of the state's claim process. So we are doing all of that.
If I could amplify on that, Mr. Chair, when the measure passed, the first order of business was to craft a claims process. I mean, that had to be done first, to create an in-basket. And that consumed certainly that first month following the date of the election, and even beyond that, as those first claims began to come in, and in fact we're in the process even of amending the claims rule as we speak, frankly, to make it more friendly to claimants, to make sure that their claims get through and evaluated more quickly. So a lot of the effort that has gone into the first front end of the measure has been work basically to create the claims process in order to receive these claims and begin to move them through. We're in that now, a good bit of the work was done just in creating that process to begin to receive those claims, and that itself was substantial. There were several legal issues, significant legal issues in creating that process that have been resolved and that are reflected in the rule. And now we're dealing with the as-applied questions as the claims come in and present the particular questions that they raise based on the facts of each different claim.
And in all difference to our counties and cities, I understand that's going to be somewhat close to herding, a bunch of cats, trying to get them to all agree, but the time involved is also important here. And they're already at the 60-day period. And Mr. Webber, you're saying it's going to take another 60 days to really get a handle on the claims. So we're at 120 days out. That only leaves 60 days left when all of these claims that have been filed initially have to be resolved. Is that going to, in your opinion, give our cities and counties enough time?
We're dealing with questions already. I mean, there are claims in the pipeline moving through. So I don't think Mr. Whitman's testimony was that we would that we would withhold, or that the state would withhold legal advice or answers for 60 days. We're dealing with claims even as they come through. And again, as I said, meeting weekly with cities and counties where they're sharing with us issues that they bring to the table. So it's not a matter of just putting this on hold for 60 days. There are things happening on a daily basis.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, those weekly meetings with cities and counties, we are addressing issues and questions that are coming up from local government in terms of how to carry out the measure on an ongoing basis. So Director Shuttle is correct. It's not as though we're waiting 60 days and then going to come out with all the answers.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you.
I'm in hopes, Lane, that you and Mr. Whitman can return to the committee and keep us updated on exactly how progress is being made in the weeks ahead. Are there any further questions? Lots of them here. Representative Summers, did you give a talk?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shatterly, I'd like you to please clarify what you said earlier. When you said that claims for land use should be made through the cities, counties, and the state to cover all the bases all at once. I was wondering, sir, if you could give us an example of a county law or city ordinance that was not a direct result of Senate Bill 100, a spinoff from land use restrictions.
Sure. Thank you, Chair, Representative Summer. For instance, I think what you'll find is that outside of urban growth boundaries, you're liable to have this two layers, where you have the state regulation and the county ordinances implementing that regulation. Inside urban growth boundaries, you'll have less of that. You may have design review standards. You may have height restrictions. You may have setbacks. You may have other things that are imposed strictly as an element of city zoning that don't have any state overlay. Those would be that would be examples of a kind of claim that may be submitted that we would have nothing to say about, because we don't have anything to do with height restrictions inside the cities, setbacks on buildings, those kinds of things.
If I could follow up, sir, but as I understand the Measure 37, those are not issues that were covered by 37. Is that true? Height restrictions and the like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sumner, I'm not sure that that's true. It's a land use regulation, and I don't want to say that it is covered, because we'll see, I guess, when we get the first claim. But I could see a claim coming through based on a height limitation, let's say, where a property owner would make a claim to a city that but for that regulation they would be able to build higher and thereby attain more value out of their property than with that regulation. So I could see a claim coming through using that as an example.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Chair of the Ride. And this might be a question for you. I'm curious what would happen to those claims that are now 60 days and they meet the 6 months requirement, and what would happen to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, by 180 days, we're going to have all these claims evaluated and out the door. Any action the legislature intervene in that, we are counting on 180 days and no more than 180 days. So the measure answers that question. If the regulation has not, if compensation has not been paid, or if the regulation has not been modified, removed, or a decision made to not apply it by the 180th day, then the property owner has a cause of action against the state, if it's of a state's responsibility, for damages in the amount of the diminution in value plus attorney fees. That is an outcome that we're going to avoid at all costs, and so we're very mindful of the timeline on these claims and don't anticipate letting any of them run over the 180 days. There will be a decision either to that it's either valid and a decision either to pay compensation or to not apply or whatever the case may be, or a decision that it's not valid, and then, you know, we'll come what may there. But we're going to make decisions. We're not going to have any of these just extend beyond 180 days.
Thank you.
Marlene, is your agency prepared right now to begin making those kind of decisions from a state basis?
Mr. Chair, we are in the process of doing that. We have not finalized any of the claims yet. I think we got our first batch from DASH maybe 2 weeks ago. And we have, as I said, five staff devoted to evaluating these. As you can imagine, being something new and a fairly heavy volume coming in, and we've got 64 of these now as of today, they're time-consuming, and each one of these presents issues of first impression. And so we've not finished any of the evaluations, but they're on track. And questions still remain, even for us, that we'll have to have answered before the 180 days runs. When it comes to a LCDC goal or administrative rule, does the commission have to make the decision? Is it sufficient for the commission to delegate to me the authority to make that decision? And what about state statutes? Does the commission or do I have the authority to to remove or not apply a state statute. That's not entirely clear. Those are questions that we'll have to have an answer to, and we'll take our best shot at it before the 180 days runs.
Representative Ackerman, would you have a question?
I'm just getting the distinct impression that your efforts are going to be devoted to processing claims within claims against the state, and that you're not going to take any particular other role in guiding us and statewide standards for the application of Measure 37 by cities and counties. And that's okay. I just want to make sure that if we're not going to rely upon you for that, that we'll have to do that as a purely legislative function. Is that how you perceive your role?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman. I think our role principally, if it's speaking for the department, is to handle the claims that come before the department. That is to resolve the issues that the claims, on the claims that come before us and get them dealt with within that 180-day time frame. To the extent that our evaluation involves legal interpretation that then we can share with cities and counties, and that's the point of this regular weekly meeting with cities and counties. To the extent that our evaluation can be of use to cities and counties, we're happy to share that and make that available. The Department of Justice, as I said, their advice is binding on us, so if they say this is the way you interpret, we do that. As you know, the Department of Justice's advice is not binding on cities and counties, so we can share that interpretation, and some cities and counties may say, thank you very much, we'll believe it. Others say, thank you very much, we're going to go our own way. And so we will lead by example in terms of how we evaluate and act on the claims, and we'll share our legal analysis as we go through that process. But it really will be up to each local government ultimately to decide for themselves what interpretation they want to apply in evaluating their own claims.
Would it not be better, Lane, for those people in state government whose job is land planning to be making those decisions and not circuit courts that have not been making these decisions in 35 years?
Mr. Chair, the obvious answer to that question is yes. Having said that, most of the questions that I think you will find that arise under the measure are not planning questions. They're legal questions as to statutory interpretation, and those our planners will take a buy on.
Okay. Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say first, I'm glad you're the one that's doing this.
I thought you liked me.
Not because I'd rather not be me, but because I have a lot of confidence in you and in your judgment. I was a little tweaked by your issue of statutes. I mean, I understand a city council or a county commission who has made an ordinance has the right to waive an ordinance, but I don't think there's any indication under separation of powers that an administrative arm of the government would have the right to waive a statute that was enacted by the legislature. I mean, you might have the authority to pay for it, but I can't imagine you have the authority to waive it.
If I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, this is one of the central, I think, things we're grappling with as we're trying to implement the measure. In order for me to describe what the issue is here, I have to give you a little bit of background on statewide land use planning. Under state law, state statutes, is a general matter, once cities and counties adopt comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances, and those are acknowledged by LCDC, those local laws control what you
I understand that issue. That's not what I'm talking about. I thought I heard Wayne say that if a claim is against the state and a possible satisfaction of that claim would be to waive a statute, that, I mean, I would wonder whether the administrative arm of government has the authority to waive an action of the legislative arm.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I just then, I'll let you back in on that, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf. Yeah, that's what I said was, that was one of the questions that we have as to the extent of our authority to waive a state statute. We're not there yet in terms of having resolved that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf. The Measure 37 has a definition for land use regulations that can give rise to claims. That definition includes state statutes that restrict the use of real property. So it is possible, based on that text, that a state statute could be the basis for a Measure 37 claim. And there are many state statutes that govern what uses can be made of land. I used the example earlier of ORS Chapter 215. That's a set of statutes that governs county land use within counties, but there are others as well. So if a claim is made to the state and it's made concerning state statutes, somebody in the state is going to have to decide whether to pay compensation or whether to... We're presuming a state agency can't remove a state statute or modify it. The question is whether a state agency may not apply a state statute based on the authority, which maybe is provided by Measure 37 itself. Now, Measure 37 itself, in that language, where it provides government with the option of doing something other than paying compensation, says the governing body may,
that's right,
may remove, modify, or not apply. So there is a question as to who can not apply a state statute if that is the basis for a claim. Does it have to be the state legislature? Can it be a state agency? Could it be a local government, a city or a county? That is a key issue that we are working through as we work to implement Measure 37 right now, and it actually pertains to this question from Jackson County.
Mr. Chair, could I bring it here? Yeah, I mean, the notion that BLCB is the governing body of the state has been taken by some people to be a matter of fact, but I think there are some of us in the other branch that don't necessarily believe that's the case. And I think we have a different case with a county application of a statute, the Jackson County thing, and the Congress of Plano, than a specific claim against a specific statute to the state, through something, the state land board decision or some other kind of statute. And if you are planning an attorney general opinion that says BLCD or the state land board or the Department of Forestry or anything else has the right to act as the governing body of the state, I think we really need to talk about it. If not here, perhaps in the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, part of the reason I wanted to get into this a little bit is DLCD and the state are going to be faced in 180 days with claims that may involve a state statute. And if the executive branch of the state does not have the authority to waive or to not apply state statutes, then people are going to be able to go to circuit court and get compensation. So unless there's some legislative action to provide some mechanism to not apply the law. So that's just one of the possible consequences of the answer to this issue that's important. Another consequence, another reason that this question is so important is if you're a property owner and you submit a Measure 37 claim that involves both a state statute and a local ordinance, and no one can make the state statute go away, then there's a chance that government may say it's not a valid claim because there's no diminution in value. So this is an issue for the state in fiscal terms. It's an issue for property owners. It's an issue state versus local. It cuts a number of different ways, and the resolution.
I argue that it's a constitutional issue as well.
So the resolution of it is something that is going to require great care and is of great concern.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, going back to Representative Smith's question. That is an important question that ultimately will have to be decided before we address any of those statutory-based claims. I can tell you, we're not waiting for that answer right now. As we're evaluating claims, we're going ahead so that we're going to have the evaluation set to go. I will tell you that if the answer should be that DLCD does not have the authority to waive the state statute, for instance, or develop one, we'll be right back at you with a request for a bill to clarify that, because that would, again, create, I think, some serious consequences both for the state as well as property owners. So we're looking at that, but we're not waiting on the claims right now that are in front of us. We'll have them set to go.
I wonder if we can win, but that's not something we need to take up specifically rather than waiting for the Attorney General. I'd certainly like to hear our alleged counsel weigh in on what their perspective is.
Maybe worthwhile.
Gentlemen, I appreciate your being here today. This issue has us all feeling uncomfortable and having to ask difficult and direct questions.
Great question.
But we appreciate you being here and you're being candid with this committee, and we thank you for your appearance.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the chance to be here. I think to keep this conversation going is invaluable. I think there are plenty of opportunities for missteps and miscommunication, and I'm happy to be here and answer these questions as direct as you want to make them.
Good. We'll have you back every week.
Yeah, I was going to say, you might just be able to fill up your agenda.
Can we go on each of those
claims? Yeah. But I do want to assure you, Mr. Chair, and I hope you've gotten the sense that we have put in a tremendous amount of work and effort in trying to make this work so far. We take that responsibility seriously, and we will continue to take that seriously in responding to the measure, and to the extent that we need legislative help to get there, we will not be afraid to ask.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, thank you. We'll close the informational testimony on the Measure 37 update, and we'll go to item number two in our informational meeting, which is Goal 9 and Industrial Lands. And I'll ask Tom Gallagher to
I must say, one of the top 10 legislators of all time is about to join us here. This is retribution. This is like a Title 37 claim. I publicly abused him earlier in the day, and he complained, and this is my payoff. Absolutely. And we could vote if he's one of the top five of all time.
Oh, you excuse me.
Okay, guys.
Tom, those seats are probably pretty warm at the moment.
Mr. Chair, it's... I thought they did an excellent job. I'm not sure what they said.
And I agree.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Gallagher. I represent the Urban Developers Coalition. I'm here to talk about industrial lands, a project that my group, the group that I represent, has been on for the last 6 years. I appreciate going first here because I'm just going to do the historical overview, and your agencies are going to fill in a lot of the specifics that they have done in the interim, and I hope to set up another round of development on the industrial land issue. I've given you a handout that is numbered, and I'm not going to read it, but I'll kind of punch through the numbers for you very quickly. Number one is the existing statutory and rulemaking language that says that everybody's supposed to have a 20-year land supply. And there's actually short-term language that says you're supposed to have short-term land available to go for industrial siting. In point number three, the LCDC has developed out of one of our bills a document called the Goal 9 Guidebook, and that has a lot of definitions in it, as you can see I've tagged here, telling us what short-term supply is. And that's a land supply that's 2 to 5 times greater than the immediate demand as based on an economic opportunity analysis. They also go on to talk about those little bullet points which would define what is short-term available industrial land. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. which says that that land would be large, flat, symmetrical configurations. There would be no development constraints. It would be have sufficient capacity for local transportation. It would be proximate to interstate highways, rail, and port transportation. The problem is that we don't have that land supply. And we've been doing quite a bit of work in the interim, not just the groups legislature has passed, but also some other groups. This is probably the seminal report that Metro did starting back in the late 1990s. This is the first of three regional industrial land studies where they looked in the metro area to see, number one, what they had for land supply, short-term, long-term, and what its constraints were. And they came up with a lot of conclusions, which basically said that it's really there really isn't much available that doesn't have significant development constraints on it. On the basis of that report, in 2001, we worked on House Bill 3557, which was nothing more than a study committee based on the language in the rule that says, go take a look and see if there is a 20-year land supply. The report that came back from OTEC and Eco Northwest pretty much said there's not a lot of short-term supply of industrial land available. There's quite a supply of long-term land, but not short-term land. That group also developed the Goal 9 handbook that I showed you. So we've been doing a lot of research and a lot of background work on these issues. The governor also got in the act in 2004 and put together an industrial lands task force and an executive order to go out and take a look at this issue. That industrial lands task force was Martha Kirkpatrick chaired, and she'll be up here after I am, helped set the stage for 2011, which passed in the last legislative session. 2011 was the short term, was the 25 site bill, they're called opportunity sites now, I think, by the department, so they're not confused with the certified sites. Greg Speck, who was here, but went across to St. Joe's to a funeral of a family friend, really back, was on that industrial land task force. They issued their report. And their report said that they were offered 55 sites to look at, which included very few large industrial sites along the I-5 between Washington and Salem. So, again, we came back with another look on the 25 sites. It said, okay, we've got some, and we're going to move on those, but and I think the number of those is 15 in the past 2 years have been moved forward to the certified level, but Lynn Beaton can talk about that in some detail. In the middle of this page, too, I've talked about these competitive market-ready sites being in short supply, that we've developed a methodology that we're now doing. The OECDD is doing their certified site analysis, and that we're ready really to go to the next stage. Another part of 2011 was protecting the industrial supply that we have, and that led to another good report in November of 2004, and now down under bullet 5, which is protecting prime industrial land. That's the first time we've really ever talked about not just having some industrial land ready to go, but having the right industrial land ready to go, and once we get it, taking care of it. Now, this is going to be an important tool for the legislature in the next couple of years and for local communities and regional communities to look at as to how they take care of and how they utilize that industrial land. Another piece, another subcommittee that came out of 2011 was to look at permit streamlining. So it's not just a land use issue you have, but it's also the permits that you have to develop. That report was called Gaining Competitive Advantage, the Streamlining Regulatory Permit Process. And if anybody wants to look at industrial land, ought to read very closely the appendices there, because we begin to point out in some detail the restraints we have inside of our system. Inadequate transportation funding is a good one. The permit process itself, having the community be supportive of the development, having the community putting aside the land and helping people develop the permits in that area. Some communities are supportive and some communities, for their own particular reasons, are not that interested. That caused us to look at the idea of industrial lanes on a regional basis rather than on a city-by-city basis. If you're, I'll use Medford, because there's quite a difference between White City and Jacksonville. You should do some development in White City that you wouldn't do in Jacksonville, or just two different kinds of communities. But there is a region which, as I understand the way that metropolitan area is developing now, it's quite interconnected, the jobs, the recreation, the other pieces in the community. Well, our original land use laws don't set it up in a regional way. They set it up community by community. And we had a community pass a bill that said every community had to have a 20-year and a short-term supply of industrial land. Well, then we'd have all sorts of extra land, as it were, set aside that would never be used for industrial purposes because it's in the wrong place. So we've gone through quite a bit of research on this, and I think the time in this session is to put our heads back down together and see if we can't develop the next round of bills, which are not research bills, but are actually deliverables. How do we identify those prime industrial sites? How do we protect them? How do we get them online with services in the short term? That means that people should have a 3 to 5 year supply of land. How do we integrate that into our economic development planning? How do we do that on a regional basis, not just a city by city basis? All of that would require some significant changes in the current land use and other statutory directives that we have to local government. So I'm here today, I know there are two bills now in NC that take a shot at solving this problem. One of them is mine, and I know it's not adequate. And I'm going to suggest that when we get done hearing all of the different people who have an interest in industrial land, that we go through a process similar to what we did last session in 2011, and that this committee take the lead in organizing a work group that would pool these bills and pool all the talent and all of the research that we've developed and see if we can come up with the next iteration for economic development. That's all I have at this point.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Tom. Are you going to stick around? Where you? Margaret Kirkpatrick. Very good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kirkpatrick. I am the Vice Chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I have an entire year of experience under my belt right now and expect to be doing this for some time. And so I would also like to thank, the Chair for an opportunity to come and address you on the Department's and the Commission's economic development agenda. I would also like to thank Tom Gallagher for the testimony that he gave setting the stage. Had an opportunity to see a draft of it yesterday, and one of the things that was quite stunning to me is how close his draft testimony was to our draft testimony. So I don't know what that says exactly about the department these days, but we're very much on the same page, so what you hear from us may be somewhat duplicative. I think the first thing I want to say is that the department and the commission are very interested in being partners in the state's efforts to get the economy back on track. And we have, as you well know, because you just spoke with him, a new director, Lane Shetterly, one of your own from past sessions. And the governor also appointed at the beginning of last year 5 new commission members out of a total body of 7. So it's a very different group than we've had in the past. I think we've gelled remarkably well. We were given a very broad direction from the governor when we were appointed, which was to put the D back in LCDC. Don't take out the C, don't de-emphasize, but also to put the D back in, and we have tried to honor the governor's directive. What I want to do is just give you a very broad overview of the commission's areas of interest in economic development and then hand it over to Ann Bio from the department to provide some details, and I think you'll also be hearing from Lynn Beaton from OECD that gives you some other details. We are working as closely as we can with OECD and the Economic Development Commission, and I think there's a beginning of a very good partnership forming there. As Tom pointed out in his testimony, there had been over the last couple of years a lot of task forces and a lot of advisory groups, some very good reports with some very strong recommendations coming out. But to date, there hasn't been much in the way of changes to administrative rules and state statutes to implement some of the ideas that have come out of the task forces and the reports. From a land use perspective, I think we all understand that economic development is an issue that is far bigger than what we can do with a land use planning program. It requires investments in education. It requires serious conversations about infrastructure investments and all of that. So we are looking at our relatively small piece of the overall puzzle and just trying to kind of keep track of what's going on in the other areas. The two pieces that we do think the Department and the Commission have some role to play, one is the land supply issue that Tom talked about quite a bit. There have been a series of task force reports that have all come to the same conclusion, just with greater refinement each time, which is to say that we do have a very serious shortage of industrial land in key areas of the state that is suitable for the kind of industry that we want to attract and has services currently provided to it or coming in the near future. So we have identified that problem, and that's one where I think the Department and OECD have made some significant progress. One can tell you a whole lot more about the Certified Sites Program, but that is well underway. There are a number of sites certified. There are more on the way, and we are trying at the Commission to do our part by taking a real serious look at our economic development goal, which is Goal 9, and providing more requirements for local governments. I don't want to make that sound bad, but asking local governments to take a much closer look at the prime industrial land in their jurisdictions, identify it, and then take steps to protect that for industrial use rather than getting frittered away for residential use or something else. So those are well underway. We're doing the Goal 9 revisions in two steps. One we're hoping to conclude by March, and then the other step is actually probably the more ambitious, and it really goes to Tom's point about encouraging regional cooperation and regional economic development planning rather than jurisdiction by jurisdiction. So I think we've made a good start in those areas. The second piece, though, that has a land use component to it is the permitting process. And one of the things Tom mentioned, that I chaired the Industrial Lands Task Force that the governor appointed and we operated in 2004. This was before I came on the commission. And one of the things that we heard as we talked to folks who've been trying to do economic development in the state is that even if we had an adequate land supply, there are a number of folks, trade and sector industry that we want to attract, family wage jobs, that could locate multiple places. We're in a global economy. They could be in other states. They could be in other countries. And they may want to be in Oregon for a variety of reasons. But they look at the timelines associated and the risks associated with our multiple permitting processes. And the fact that you may have a site that needs a wetlands permit and a site that needs a land use permit and a site that needs some kind of a water pollution control facility permit, a water right maybe, and you have to go to different entities to get those permits. They all have different processes and different appeal paths, and they each have permitting risk. And that is very off-putting, we are told, to folks that we're trying to attract to the state. As Tom mentioned, and we haven't done anything concrete to address that problem yet. As Tom mentioned, there is a concept that he put in. There's another one that we have taken a look at, so there are in Legislative Council right now two concepts that are being drafted that would address this problem. And what I can tell you from the Commission's perspective is that when those come out with bill language, we will be taking a very close look at them and hoping to be involved in whatever work group might be set up and whatever legislative effort is made to address this second problem. And that's really all I have to say, so I'd be happy to answer questions or hand it over to Ann.
Thank you, Margaret, very much.
Thank you, Margaret.
For the record, my name is Ann Byer. I'm Planning Services Division Manager with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Again, thank you for inviting us here. I've been asked to give you an update on what we've been doing since the last legislative session to address economic development, particularly as directed by House Bill 2011. Before I start, I want to acknowledge that this has been a new effort for the Department. We've always had a statewide planning goal doing economic development, but this is the first time we've really had the resources to focus on it. We also have had the benefit of a lot of other people helping us out, whether they're from state agencies, local governments, Tom Gallagher and the development community. We've had a broad range of experts to help us shape our policy, so we're very, very fortunate to have that volunteer input, and we couldn't have done it without that advice. House Bill 2011 gave us about five tasks to focus on, and I'll just give you an update on each of those. I think you've been given our industrial land conversion report. The bill asked us to look at whether or not the conversion of industrial lands for other uses was a problem in the state meeting its supply of industrial land. And we looked at it, we looked at the records that we had in the department showing local governments had changed planning designations. We talked to people throughout the state, and the general agreement was that, yeah, conversion is happening. It's a natural evolution. Our older industrial areas turn into commercial areas, turn into residential areas. It's not necessarily a bad thing. The bad thing is that we may not have enough land to meet all those needs, commercial, industrial, residential, and we may be losing some prime industrial land. And we're still, frankly, struggling with what prime industrial land is, but we know that it's land that's got valuable infrastructure that may be of a large enough acreage to attract a certain kind of developer. But there was a strong feeling by our committee that the state had an interest in helping local governments protect that prime land from conversion to other uses. So as we go through our policymaking, that's what we're focusing on. Local governments still will decide how to change their planning designations for other uses, but where there's really prime land, the state has an interest in making sure that's available for employment uses. House Bill 2011 asked us to look at our administrative rule process for expanding urban growth boundaries. My colleague Bob Lindy has been working on that for about the last year. They have draft rule language out now and are looking at simplifying, streamlining that process, clarifying the requirements so that local governments can better meet the need for industrial and other land. Working with the economic revitalization team on the certified land process, our regional representatives who are located throughout the state have been working with the economic revitalization teams and local governments to work out any of the land use issues associated with those sites, and we've been involved in that process for the last year. I think Tom mentioned our guidebook to implement Goal 9 to help local governments figure out how to do these economic opportunity analysis, to figure out how the local government wants to grow its employment base in the future, and then how to identify the land needed to fulfill those employment needs. We're trying to put that process into English, make a workbook that local government planners can take and use and plug in numbers, make it very simple so they don't have to hire consultants for all their work, to just streamline that process. We've also been able to devote some of our grant funding to help local economic development efforts. We received $200,000 from the legislature last year to fund local government economic development efforts. We have about 10 grants throughout the state to do those efforts, and I'd be happy to get you a list of communities we funded. We've also devoted about half of our pool of technical assistance grants to do local economic opportunity analysis. I think our pool of money is about $800,000 over the biennium, and about half of that has gone for local governments to assess their industrial and commercial lands needs. We've also participated with the other economic revitalization team agencies on the regulatory permitting group and those kinds of things, and that's why I think we've learned so much that we are very consistent with our findings with Mr. Gallagher. We've all listened to the same conversations and come up to the same conclusions. The other piece we're working on right now is revisions to our Goal 9 administrative rule. The goal directs local governments to plan for land, to make land available for a variety of employment opportunities, economic opportunities. And what we found is over time, local government plans haven't been updated to really address the economic development needs. They've identified land supplies for residential uses, but not always for industrial, commercial, or institutional uses. So again, we're looking at the rule to try to streamline that process. We're also trying to make clear our expectations that local governments provide a short-term supply of land that's available for employment needs, and to really focus on that short-term supply so that when somebody or an opportunity comes knocking, there's land available. We've also asked them to start thinking about identifying prime sites so that we can work with them to protect that for larger employers who might come to town. We also have learned that the land use system, as Margaret says, only gets us so far. There are pieces in economic development that planning just doesn't respond to. When the next in town comes knocking, we may not have planned for the perfect site for them. The land use system was never really designed to do that. So that's what we'll be asking for your help, to create a process to help figure out where we put those kind of economic opportunities. As Margaret said, our Goal 9 process, we're only in the first round. We hope to have the commission approve our draft rule in March. We'll tackle those larger issues of regional economic planning because we think that's really where the state needs to be, and continue to work on that. As Margaret said, we look forward to participating in any legislative work group. We see we can get so far with our rule changes, but there's a bigger process out there that we'd like to be part of. So thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Margaret and both of you are to be complimented on your diligent efforts to get this information to the legislature and to those interested parties. We compliment you on a nice job.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. Lynn Beaton.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Beaton, and I'm the manager of the Central Operations Division for the Economic and Community Development Department. And you've already heard a very good background, I think, of some of the issues that we're dealing with as we try to locate and get industrial sites really ready to develop. So I'm going to keep my comments brief and just tell you specifically what our department's doing right now. We were asked to come today to talk about what we have done to implement the pieces of House Bill 2011 that apply to our agency. And there are two main things that we've done. One is, you have a copy of the Economic Development Strategy for Oregon in your packet, and we have worked with a lot of other agencies, as well as counties and cities, ports, and other business entities to try to put this study together and to prepare it. I'm not going to walk you through this today, but the second goal of the four goals in this study gives the direction to the state to work with local communities to get industrial sites ready to develop. And so that very closely links to the second task that we were given under the House bill, which is to develop a program for certifying industrial lands. What does it take to really get property ready to develop? And a historically, what we have had happen at times is that a community will think that there's land ready to develop. So they call us up and say, we want to have a company come in. We want you to show us the site. We bring a company in, walk around the property and talk to them and find out that there are issues that are really going to be a problem. Maybe there's not transportation in place. Maybe the site has wetlands or brownfields that haven't been addressed. So we're realizing that properties that we thought were ready to go really weren't. So what does it take to get those lands ready to develop? We decided to develop a state certified program. So let's figure out a way of identifying and gathering the information that's really needed so that when a business walks in the door, that you can hand them information on the site that gives them all the answers that they need in order to decide if that site's really ready for them. In doing that, we worked with a nationally recognized site selection consultant, as well as a lot of the other agencies involved with the economic revitalization team. And what we developed isn't quite as painful as it looks, but it's a checklist. It's at the front of this book. And for each site that we have certified, we fill out the checklist and gather a lot of information that we put in a book. Once we've got this information gathered, we send it back to that third-party site selector who reviews it and decides whether or not the site really is ready to go. Once they sign off, and the economic revitalization team, so the directors of those 8 state agencies sign off, we've got ourselves a certified site that we can then market.
Well, how many such requests have you had to date?
Originally, we had over 150 sites that communities brought forward that they wanted to put through the process. At this time, what we've got, and you have a map, are 22 certified sites as of today. They're spread around the state. You can see the map. In addition to the map, you've just got a list of those sites. And on that list, it explains those sites that are currently certified, so the 22 that you see on the map, as well as 5 additional sites that we believe are going to be pending. We've got the site selector looking at that information now, so we're hoping they'll soon be certified. And then we're also listing an additional 10 sites that are in the next round. So this is an ongoing process, and what we are expecting is that communities and landowners will continue to bring forward sites that they want to be certified, and then we, our department, as well as the other agencies, will walk them through this process and help them put the information together. I do want to say that one thing that's kind of unique about Oregon is that the other states that have developed certified lands programs haven't involved the state agencies up front. Instead, the property owner has to get that checklist and walk around to each of the agencies, him or herself, to get the information. So we're trying to make that a little bit easier on landowners by actually working with them up front to get that information developed. One thing I wanted to explain that gets a little confusing for people, as Tom mentioned, there are opportunity sites and then there are what we normally refer to as standard certified sites. The standard sites are those that we're going to keep certifying as time goes on. House Bill 2011, however, required that we also identify 25 opportunity sites as a one-time thing up front. The goal was to really find 25 sites that if they were ready to develop would be highly marketable. And usually sites are marketable if they're on I-5 corridor, if they have good infrastructure, if they're large, if they're flat, and if they don't have environmental constraints. So we had a committee that we worked with that identified those sites. 15 of those opportunity sites are included in the 22 that you see on your list. So I think with that I will probably stop because I just wanted to give you a brief sense of the process. I really do agree with what Tom, Margaret, and Anne are saying, and that we still do have some issues with land use. I'll be honest, a lot of times land use is helpful for us because if a site is zoned industrial use, that's great. We're ready to go. And so a lot of companies even coming into the state like that part of our land use program because it gives them certainty once that site is really identified as industrial. The problem comes up when every once in a while something that's zoned industrial really isn't the right property anymore. When we zoned these 20 years ago, it was for a different type of development than we're seeing today. So we're realizing we're really having to change and try to attract a different industry and identify different sites. And that's when we do start sometimes having problems with land use in terms of getting those changes made. So our department is very committed to continuing to work on this. We're also interested in yet another committee, having served on a number of them myself. It's always fun. So I think that we could see some real value in continuing to work with the other agencies as well as our external partners to see what we can do with the land use issues surrounding industrial sites. Thank you.
Any questions? Lynn, what's the average size of an inquiry from an outside the state business? What's the average size of an industrial site?
You mean what they'd like to see?
Yeah, the most desirable.
Well, yes, it depends on the type of industry you're attracting, right. But we're really trying to normally find sites that are 50 acres or larger, preferably over 100.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do those have to have infrastructure present?
It's really helpful, yes, if you've got roads and water, sewer, et cetera, going to a site. What we're trying to do with certified site is not say that every one of them is served right now, but that we've gone through the steps so that if a company walks in the door, within 6 months, we could have that infrastructure in place. That's the goal.
Airports, transportation, availability, all that kind of thing.
Depending on what they need. Again, we certify the sites for different industry types because some industry need airports, some don't. So we certify them by type, and so that's can be unique to a site.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Committee, I think the appropriate thing to do here, and to help Lynn and others like her, is maybe stop naming committees and try to get some legislation going that will enable you to accomplish or something real. So I'm going to ask Tom Gallagher to head up a work group. And Tom, I'm going to leave it up to you to name the interested parties and advise the committee who they would be and report back to this committee in hopes that we can possibly introduce some legislation that will assist you in your goal. Do you accept that, Tom? Like he's got a big choice here. Is your lunch gone? Or
Yeah, we can do that. I lost my list already, though. So we've already talked with the agencies and some of the individuals, and there are about 12 people that will start to meet fairly regularly, including folks in the governor's office. So
please let our administrator know who those people are.
Right after I find my list.
And we'll look forward to seeing you come back to this committee. Thank you, Tom. We're seeing no more business before this committee. We will adjourn the land. Remember, no meeting on Friday, folks, and so we'll see you Monday. Adjourn the House Committee on Land Use.